Hey, it's really exciting to be at Buckhead today. As Elizabeth said, my name is Gavin. I'm the lead pastor at Woodstock City Church. We like to think of ourselves as the ITP of the OTP, and so we're up in Woodstock having a great time. We actually have a church just like this up there that's a part of this big family of churches, and it's fun to be here. This is actually my very first time being at Buckhead on a Sunday morning. I've been around North Point for 10 years, and I've never been able to make it on a Sunday morning. So if you're here for the very first time, me too, man. So way to go. Way to go. Solidarity. We're in it together. And no, I'm excited about it. And hey, I hope your weekend has been great too. I don't know what you've done all weekend. I will tell you that I did something yesterday that I didn't know was possible. I have four kids. My youngest is turning 11, actually tomorrow. We had a birthday party for her yesterday. She wanted to invite two of her closest friends and go do yoga together, which I thought, well, that's cool. I've never done yoga. Like, I like to work out, but you know, I'm not very stretchy, but okay. I'll go do yoga. And then she said, no, we're going to do something different. It's called goat yoga. Have any of you ever heard of goat yoga? Have you anybody done goat yoga? Yeah, really? It's ridiculous. Like, I didn't know this was a thing. So yesterday, my daughter, we went, that's a legitimate goat. And I know you're thinking, oh, that's so sweet, right? But they're invalids. They're wild. They like pee and poo and all that. Like, I'm trying to do poses and avoid stuff at the same time. It's not that relaxing. My daughter and her friends were there. We had yoga mats, right? And I turn around, they're doing no yoga at all. They're literally just petting the goats. And I'm like, we could have done this for $4.50 at the petting zoo. Like, we didn't have to go to goat yoga for it. I tried to do the yoga. This is me. And with a goat on me. He just jumped right up there, you know? So anyway, if you've never done goat yoga, congratulations. I don't really recommend it. No, I'm just kidding. You should try it. Don't try it. It was weird. But anyway, it was fun. Obviously the weekend had some interesting moments for me. I don't know about you. Of course, a couple of days before that was Thanksgiving. That's a big deal. I don't know if your Thanksgiving was great. Oftentimes there are family involved in Thanksgiving, and that can make it not so great. All of us have that weird family member. If you don't really know who that person is, maybe you, I don't know. But the family part of Thanksgiving can make it a little bit difficult, but it's pretty awesome. I love Thanksgiving. There's a lot about Thanksgiving I love. In fact, I've been going to our in-laws' house now. We've been married for almost 23 years. And so I've got a lot of practice going to my in-laws for Thanksgiving. And I really love it in my in-laws. My mother-in-law is an incredible cook. My wife does a great job cooking. She's so good. We have a couple other people in the family that are just really great cooks. And so the preparation, though, for Thanksgiving is really significant. And I don't mean the cooking. I think that's significant, too. I've never done that. But like the preparing to eat part, that takes some real planning and some preparation. Like, I train for this at this point in my life. I'm 44. Like, you don't just show up to a marathon and a sprint at the same time and be successful. Like, you gotta work on it. So I like to begin my training. Maybe you do this 3 days in advance is when I start. I like to eat as much as I can on Monday before Thanksgiving. And I mean a lot of food, because what you wanna do is you wanna stretch your stomach as much as you can on Monday. And then you want to start purging, though, on Tuesday and Wednesday, because you want to show up Thursday with a really big stomach, but you want it to be empty. That's really how you can be successful at Thanksgiving. I encourage my clients who train with me to borrow some maternity pants, because, you know, you're going to have a food baby. You might as well just own that. And I like the sweatpants better than maternity pants. Two reasons. One, the sweatpants are good because there's elastic in them. That's a win. But also because of the meat sweats. And you're already wearing sweatpants, so you're super prepared, right? I was kidding. All right, so Thanksgiving is fun, right? I do like the eating, all joking aside. And there's traditional food we have, probably like you guys. I mean, there's turkey and ham and lots of rolls. I do a lot of rolls. However, the pies are my favorite. Chocolate pie, absolute favorite. I love chocolate pie. But there is a tradition that we always have in my in-law's house that I absolutely hate. And we call it the saying of grace. I don't mean the prayer. I don't hate the prayer part, but we all go around the room before we can eat, and we all have to say one thing that we're grateful for. Now, let me tell you, the reason I hate it is because every year I go there with my family, and I've got four kids, and they're all sitting beside me, and this giving of thanks moment is like a litmus test for their ungrateful hearts. And it's like a failure moment as a parent every time. Like, I know that they're gonna get to them at some point and they're gonna share what they're grateful for, and I'm gonna be disappointed. I'm like, you've had 364 days to come up with something better than that. And this is what you came up with, you know? In fact, let's do, before I tell you what they said, let's do this. Can you just turn to somebody beside you? Take like 30 seconds. Just say one thing that you're thankful for. And don't look weird or stare like, oh, I got nothing. It's been a year, okay? Over the last year, what's one thing that you are thankful for? Turn to your neighbor and just tell them one thing. Can you do that? All right, everybody have a chance? I heard in the first service, somebody told me that, somebody in the first service who's married told me that the wife turned to the husband and said, you, and the husband turned to the wife and immediately said, cheesesteaks. So I don't know if that's good or bad. It explained their relationship, they told me so. All right, so the reality is we have so much to be grateful for, right? So when we start this tradition every year, my mother-in-law always goes first. She always says the same thing, and I don't mind because she's really sincere and she cooked all the food. You can say whatever you want if you cook all the food. She says her family and her grandchildren and her children, and I'm like, oh, that's really sweet because she means it. And I think one day, I mean, hopefully, Lord willing, I'll be a grand, not mother, but father one day, and I hope I'll look around and have grandkids and can be thankful for that. That would be amazing. You know, it's like 50 years away, but it would be really fun, you know, whenever that happens. So we go around the room, you know, my father-in-law, he's a tree climber. That's a club. You can do that. He's a tree climber. He's thankful for, like, you know, things that are tree climbing stuff and the family and children, grandchildren. Of course, you have to say that. Well, eventually it gets to my kids, right? And I'm just watching. I'm like, well, this is going to be super disappointing, you know, and a reflection on me as a parent. My youngest child, the one who you saw doing the goat yoga, she's still really sweet. She's only 11, right? She hasn't puberty'd her way into being arrogant and a jerk yet. So she's 11. She looks up and she says, I'm just really thankful for my siblings and my parents. I thought, oh, that's so sweet. She threw parents in because she wanted to ask for goat yoga, you know, the next day. And then I was just grateful she used the word siblings appropriately. She's 11. That was impressive, you know? Then we get to my ninth grade son. He's not as sweet anymore. And I look at my ninth grade son. I'm like, well, what are you thankful for? He goes, I don't know, Christmas? I'm like, Christmas, it's Thanksgiving. Like, don't skip the holiday. Like, don't skip ahead, you know? And it just got worse, you know? It just kind of went off the rails from there. And I thought, as I watched these kids, I thought, we all have so much to be grateful for. And you as kids, you have it so good. You don't even know how good you have it. And I don't mean like when I was a kid, you know, it was terrible, but look how good. Not like that. Like, I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't walk uphill both ways through the snow to school or anything. I mean, I grew up in Atlanta. I walked through humidity, if anything, and which is way worse than snow if we're thinking about it. But it wasn't hard for me. I had it pretty good too. But my kids, they just have it so easy. I mean, if we really wanted to take this tradition seriously, we could talk for hours about the things we're grateful for. I mean, we could spend a whole day just on kind of the material possessions that we have. You know, like my kids could be thankful for so much, like electricity and cars and a car that runs on electricity. That's my 17-year-old. He has no gas money. He should be really thankful for that electricity. I pay for that, by the way, and he uses it every night, you know? I mean, they could be thankful for things like Xboxes and clothes and Fortnite. I mean, there's a lot to be thankful for, especially if you're a kid. But we could go deeper than that, right? Like at Thanksgiving at the time, at least, we could have been thankful for our health. And we weren't as healthy after Thanksgiving when the meal set in, but before Thanksgiving, you know, like before the meat sweats, we had a lot to be thankful for when it came to our health. We could be thankful for our family. It was fun to have family there and to even be able to have family gather for Thanksgiving. That's something that we could be grateful for. We had friends that came over for Thanksgiving and got to participate in the meal with us. That was fun just to have friends around. If you've ever kind of been around the world and seen the way other people live, we could be really grateful that we even have places to live. We could be grateful that we have a home. Most of us even have a home for our car. It's a garage, right? I mean, we could be thankful for that. We could be thankful that we have so much food. And I don't even mean like the Thanksgiving food. Like, I bet very few people are worried about what you're gonna eat later today. I mean, we could really be grateful for that. What I really want my family to have at some point in their life, I want them to own this thing we're gonna call an attitude of gratitude. Like, that's what I really want them to have. Now, I know that seems kind of corny. It sounds like one of those inspirational posters, right? Like, you know, your attitude determines your altitude. Ah, ah, as you fly away. I mean, I know. It sounds corny. But isn't it true? Like, Our life would be so much better if we had that attitude of gratitude. Like if we could walk around somehow really grateful, like if we could show up to a Thanksgiving event and go around and when it got to you, you were like, oh my gosh, you should sit down because I got a lot. Because I have an attitude of just so grateful. There's so much to be thankful for. When my kids were younger, I started thinking about how to help instill this attitude of gratitude in their heart. And obviously every Thanksgiving, I realized how much of a failure we've been, but I wanted to instill it. And so I thought the best way to do it, I think, is to expose them to something that will prove that they should be grateful. I thought the best way to do it, this seems foolproof, is to take them on a mission trip. Like I've been on mission trips. I've been to other countries. I've been in the slums in, you know, Nairobi, Kenya. I've been in other places and seen how other people live or how life could be if, you know, by not the grace of God, happened to be born where I was born and the family that I was born to. It could just as easily been me. And so when you go see those things, you don't come back, I mean, unchanged. I mean, it changes your heart. In fact, it kind of begins to build an attitude of gratitude. And so I thought I should take my kids one at a time on one of these trips because there is no way you can go and see a third world country, see people in poverty who aren't even sure if they're gonna get a next meal. It's impossible to be exposed to that, to see it, and then complain about how long it takes for Fortnite to load. I mean, you just can't, right? Because it changes your heart. So I thought I'm gonna do that. There's this organization called Compassion International. Maybe you've heard of them. You can sponsor children through them. They work all over the world in these impoverished communities where they come in and help children get a leg up with education and work and, of course, spirituality too. It's just a beautiful thing they do. And so I had an opportunity to go on a trip with them. And they said I could bring one person with me. And I immediately thought, I'm not going to bring my wife. She's already super grateful. I'm bringing one of my kids. And so I kind of nicknamed this trip. I didn't tell my daughter, but we were going to call it the Gratitude Attitude Missionary Experience Adjustment because she was going to get an adjustment while we were over there, and she was going to come back so different. In fact, on the flight to Ecuador, I thought the whole time, this is about to change her world. Talk about an inspirational poster. She will be the poster child for gratitude inspirational posters because what she's about to see is gonna be so distinctly different than anything she'll ever see in our neighborhood. We flew into Ecuador, we went to Quito, that's where we landed. I don't know if you've ever been to Ecuador. I was a little disappointed when I got to Quito because it looks kind of like Atlanta. I mean, there's all these high rises and these beautiful mountains there, and there's nice hotels. We stayed in this really nice hotel, had some of the best coffee I've ever had in my life that next morning. But then we got to get on the van finally and head out of Quito into the mountains of Ecuador. And it's freezing cold. Ecuador is kind of even on the equator, but the altitude is so high, it's really cold. And so we visited this remote mountain village, and we got to serve hundreds of children a meal. Some of them, I don't know, had eaten all day, maybe even in a couple of days. And I got to watch my daughter walk around with these trays and serve these meals to these sweet little children. It was such a beautiful thing to watch. And then we got to play with them and played soccer, and they had this makeshift kind of playground. And so that was one day. The next day, we got on a little airplane. We flew out of the mountains into the Amazon River Basin area of Ecuador. And we took this cool boat that had a motor on it. It was like a really long canoe. And we were in the Amazon River kind of tributary. And I thought, we could easily die here, right? People die here, but we didn't. Obviously, I'm here. We made it to the Amazon village. It was the coolest thing, right? Same thing, though. A very poverty-stricken kind of remote village in the middle of this rainforest. We got to help a mother clear out her garden with machetes, which I thought was a little scary giving 12-year-old machetes, but we saw 6-year-olds with them, so seems like they knew what they were doing. 12-year-old, she could figure it out too, and so we got to make some crafts with them. Again, we got to serve these children meals. I mentioned I was with Compassion, and there was a few children in the village that had not been sponsored yet. My daughter and I got to meet this sweet little boy, and we got to sponsor him while we were there. It was a really special moment, you know? So we go back to Quito. The next morning, we're getting ready to fly out. And I am just so grateful for this entire trip. And I'm mostly grateful because my daughter is never going to see the world again, right, the same way. Like, it's going to change her heart. We get on the airplane. We're flying back to Atlanta. And I begin asking my daughter about the trip. I'm like, hey, what was your favorite part of the trip? You know, she says, oh, getting to meet, you know, the child we sponsor now and getting to kind of play with him and know that that's the kid, you know, that we're going to give some money to every month. I was like, yeah, no, that was really special. Like what was unexpected? Now, here's what I'm doing, right? I'm setting her up for the real question. And the real question is, aren't you just so grateful for what you have? Like, I'm setting her up, right? So right before I got to that question, I paused for a minute. And I don't know why I pause. I usually speak before I think and think later and realize, oh, I should have thought more, right? But I paused for a second. And I thought, I don't know that that's the best question that I could ask her. Like, I'm not sure gratitude is the best goal here. Like, I want you to be grateful. I want you to have this attitude of gratitude, but maybe there's something better. Like, maybe there's something bigger. I actually kind of realized in that moment that gratitude was good. I mean, gratitude is a good thing. But while gratitude is good, there may be something even greater than just being grateful. In fact, when I began to think about that on the airplane, this parable that Jesus taught kind of popped into my mind, which I know is super Christian nerdy of me to say that, but I mean, I'm a professional Christian. I get to do this for a living, so that's not too weird for me. So this parable popped into my mind, and maybe you know how Jesus did this. He constantly was teaching in parables because stories are so sticky. So he would make up these stories that had these eternal meanings to them, this bigger than life meaning, and he would tell these stories all the time. Matthew was one of the disciples. He was there when Jesus told this one parable I'm gonna share with you in a second, and he wrote that parable down for us. And so it's cool when you read things that Matthew wrote because he was right there front and center. He had a first-person perspective we get to read about. So Matthew captured this parable. And in every parable that Jesus taught, for the most part, God is one of the characters, and we are one of the characters. We're never the good character. God's always the great character, and we're the ones trying to figure life out. And it's the same kind of thing in this parable. It's the parable of this master who goes on a journey, and he gives his servants, us, different kinds of wealth as he goes. And the whole story, the parable, is about what happens with those servants when they were entrusted with this wealth. Here's kind of how Jesus started the parable. He said, again, the kingdom of heaven can be illustrated by the story of a man who's representing God, who's going on this long trip. He called together his servants and he entrusted his money to them while he was gone. Now, this is really important. He's not entrusting just a little bit of his money. The parable says that he's entrusting all of his money with his servants, which means this master must be a pretty good guy and a really wealthy guy, and he must really trust these servants. I mean, in today's world, to turn to someone who's even a friend and say, hey, I'm going on a long trip. Here's a couple of $1 million while I'm gone. Will you please manage it for me? I mean, that seems insane to do that. Can you imagine 2,000 years ago to turn to your servants? And it's hard to kind of equate how much real money this was, but it probably was in the millions of dollars. And most people had no money. And so to have that much wealth and then turn to your servants and say, hey, I'm entrusting this to you. It's a really, really big deal. Everybody in the crowd, you know, was taken aback. Whoa, who would do that? And Jesus went, exactly. Not many people would do that, but God would. Now, here's kind of how the giving of the wealth plays out in the story. He gave 5 bags of silver to one, 2 bags of silver to another, and 1 bag of silver to the last, dividing it in proportion to their abilities. Then he went on his trip. Now, quick pause in the parable. This is the subplot that I really don't like in the parable because the implications of this are that when God was handing out abilities, he was not trying to be fair, which I kind of wish he was fair. Because if he was being fair, I would be 6'5 and playing in the NBA right now. That was my favorite sport as a kid, and obviously I did not make it. So if God was trying to be fair, we would all be a little bit the same. Yet, how boring would that be, right? I mean, the implications are that some people are 5-bagger people and some people aren't. In fact, let me ask you a question. Like, how would you feel if you were one of those 5-bagger people? Like, how would you feel if you were a 5-bagger person in the story? I have a feeling you'd feel pretty grateful, especially if you were a 5-bagger person and you look beside you and there was a little 1-bagger guy, you know? Like, you've got so much silver in these bags, you can't even possibly pick it up, and the one guy here is holding it like this, you know? Like, I know how you'd feel. You'd feel really grateful because you'd look at him and think, well, at least I'm not that guy. I feel really grateful, you know? Let me flip it though. How would you feel if you were a 1-bagger person? Maybe not as grateful, maybe a little bit envious. This is kind of icky to admit, but when we were going on that mission trip with my daughter, I think part of me actually began to believe that we were the 5-bagger Americans going to visit the 1-bagger Ecuadorians. And we were gonna bring all of our American good stuff and we were gonna serve these poor people who were in need. They only had 1 bag, we had 5 bags, right? That's kind of how we act sometimes. That isn't the point of the story, right? God has put us all in unique positions and he's given us all different abilities and gifts. He's made some of you accountants and he's made some of you me, right? We're just different. And that's a good thing. In fact, that's something that we should ultimately celebrate. That's a part of what's happening in this parable. So as we kind of continue the parable, look how Jesus tells it. He says, the servant who received the 5 bags of silver began to invest the money and he earned 5 more. The servant with two bags of silver also went to work, and he earned two more. It's kind of a big deal. But the servant who received the one bag of silver dug a hole in the ground, and he hid the master's money. Now, that seems really weird to us contextually, right? None of us probably bury our valuables, bury our money. But I mean, back then, if you had any version of wealth, it put you ahead of almost everybody around you. And so you would do anything it took to protect that wealth. And so burying it in the earth wasn't that crazy of an idea, because at least nobody could steal it from you. And at least when the master came back, it wouldn't be gone. Like, you could go back to your master and say, hey, look, I still have the money. I hid it, but I still have it for you. I protected it for you. Seems like maybe not the worst idea. After a long time, the parable continues. After a long time, their master returned from his trip, and he called them together to give an account of how they had used his money. So the five-bagger guy comes up to his master, and he says, hey, thank you so much for entrusting me with this great wealth. I have used your wealth, and I have earned you five more bags of silver. And the master is so excited. Jesus says that he actually turns to the servant, and he says, that is unbelievable. Thank you so much. In fact, I'm going to treat you like one of my own. Come and celebrate with me and my family, because we're equals in this. Well, the two-bagger guy, he's getting pretty pumped, right? Because he did the same thing. The two-bagger guy comes running up with his four bags of silver. And he says, master, I did the same thing. I invested, I used your money well, and I turned it into two more bags. I don't know if you're counting, but that's 14 bags of silver now, master, that you have, not just seven. What do you think about that, right? Or 12 bags. Did I get it wrong? Yeah, 12 bags of silver, right? I'm not a math guy. So 12 bags of silver, that's amazing. The master says, you are absolutely right. I am so grateful that you put it to use well. You should celebrate with me too. We're gonna throw a party. You're invited as well. Of course, the one bagger guy, he has this bag he's holding, and it's full of dirt, right? Because he's dug it up. And then when the one servant with the one bag of silver came, and he began to say, and I don't know if there was like a real soundtrack playing, but if it was, it sounded just like Jaws. Because this guy was about to be in for a surprise, right? He was about to be, in a way, eaten alive, right? Here's what the master says. What he says to the master: master, I knew that you were a harsh man, harvesting crops where you didn't plant and gathering crops that you didn't cultivate, which is a little strange, because this master seems like a pretty cool guy. Like, he doesn't seem like he's that harsh. I mean, he just gave away all of his wealth, millions of dollars, to these people to manage, and they all could have stolen it. They could have run away with it. They could have squandered it. He doesn't seem that harsh. He seems like a pretty good guy. Seems like a guy we'd all want to be friends with, a guy that we would love to have around us. But of course, if you've done something you might not should have done, I think you do get a little afraid, and you begin to make excuses maybe for your behavior. The servant continues. He says, I was afraid I would lose your money, so I hid it in the earth. Look, here is your money back. Here, it's all back. Now, in this parable, this hiding of money is kind of the equivalent of hiding anything that's been entrusted to you. Like, everything we have, God has given to you. God has given to us. And so if God gives you something and your kind of response is to hide it in the ground or to not use it in any way, it seems like God doesn't love that idea. It seems like that when God entrusts things to us, he does it for a reason, because he wants us to use it, to do something with it. That's kind of the point of the parable. And so anytime you get something and you hide it, it doesn't seem like that's what the master, what our Heavenly Father is really after when he entrusts things to this. In fact, that's what Jesus kind of says in the parable. But the master replied, you wicked and lazy servant. If you knew I harvested and didn't plant it and gathered crops I didn't cultivate, why didn't you deposit my money in the bank? I mean, if you'd have done that, at least I could have gotten some interest on it. Then he ordered, take the money from the servant and give it to the one with 10 bags of silver. And then he kind of punctuates this parable. Here's kind of what Jesus says to end it. He says, to those who use well what they are given, even more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who do nothing, even what little they have will be taken away. And then he says this kind of harsh thing, but I think it's true. He says, now throw this useless servant out into the utter darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, which sounds really harsh on the surface. But I bet you know people, because I do too, who got to the end of their life and God had given them so much and had entrusted so much to them. And at the end of their life, they had not much to show for it. They in a way squandered it, or maybe they buried it, or their version of burying it, and really didn't do much with it. And at the end of their life, they didn't look back and feel grateful. You know what they did? They looked back weeping. There was some gnashing of teeth because they didn't use well what God had entrusted to them, which is really the point of the whole parable. And what's interesting about this parable, and I think this is why it came to mind on that flight back home with my daughter, is because there was no moment where the master rewarded people for being grateful. Like, there was no moment where the master said, hey, I know you buried the money and you didn't do anything with it, but that's okay. As long as you're grateful, we're good. Like, gratitude wasn't celebrated and gratitude wasn't even really rewarded. When I was flying back with my daughter, this is what I began to wonder. What if gratitude is good, but what if there's something greater? Like, what if there's something bigger than just being grateful? And here's what I realized, is that if we're gonna build gratitude this way, it's only gonna work in one way anyway. Like, if we're gonna build gratitude through comparison, it's only gonna work in one direction. Like it's easy to feel grateful when you're in Ecuador and everybody doesn't really have a meal and you have all you can eat. It's easy to feel grateful. But what's gonna happen when we get back home? See, it's easy to feel grateful when you're in Ecuador, but then you get back home and your best friend got a new Jeep and you don't. How do you feel now, right? Like, it's easy to feel grateful when you're the, you know, five bagger and you're around the one bagger. But what if you're a two bagger? Like, how do you feel if you're a two bag person? I mean, you look at the one bag person and maybe you feel grateful, but then you'll get the five bag, not as much. That's the problem with gratitude, especially if it's kind of built around comparison. And I began to realize, I don't want my daughter to feel grateful because of what she has in comparison to what other people don't have. That seems like a recipe for gratitude kind of failure. Seems like a recipe to show up on Thanksgiving and go around the table and have nothing really great to say again. Instead of just feeling grateful, I just decided, I think I want my daughter to use well what she's been given. Not just be grateful for what she has, but to use what she has for something way bigger than her. Another way to say it is, I don't want her to just feel grateful. I really just want her to feel responsible. I want her to feel responsible because God has entrusted some things to her. And I want her to feel responsible as a steward of what's entrusted, as a manager of what's been entrusted. And the reality is that gratitude is good. There's nothing wrong with gratitude. I mean, gratitude is good, but responsibility is so much greater than just gratitude. And here's why. Gratefulness kind of spotlights what we already have. In a lot of ways, gratefulness highlights yourself. It highlights what you already have. It'd be easy to say that gratefulness can lead to a little bit of selfishness, because gratefulness focuses our hearts, our lives on ourselves. It spotlights us. But responsibility does something different. Responsibility begins to focus us on using well what we have. So we're not just grateful that we have it. We begin to consider how we can use well what we've been given. And you know why this is really important for those of us that are Jesus followers? Because the reason God entrusted things to us is because he wants to partner with you and he wants to partner with me to help move the kingdom of God forward. He wants to partner with you and he's given you these gifts, these abilities, these talents. He's given you wealth, he's given you opportunities, but he gave it to you for something way bigger than you. And he gave it to you for something way bigger than just gratitude. He actually gave it to you so you could be responsible with it. And through your responsibility, move the needle in the kingdom of God, maybe across the world, or maybe just in one person's world. But either way, it's worth being responsible, because we get to help people grow in their relationship with Jesus when we move past just simple gratitude. You know what I love about this idea is that it's at all scale for us. Like, it doesn't even matter how much you have to be responsible with what you have. I'll never forget, I heard Andy say this one day. He said that what you have matters way less than what you do with what you have, which is so cool, because it doesn't matter how much God has entrusted you. It doesn't matter if you're a five-bag person, a two, or a one-bag person. Whatever God has given you, there's an opportunity to leverage it for something way, way bigger than you. And that's actually what I began to think about on that plane ride home. In fact, I never even asked my daughter, aren't you grateful for what you have? I'm kind of glad I stopped and didn't ask her because I really didn't want her to feel that way. I wanted her to feel something bigger than that. But I bet like you, if you're a parent like I am, you know that oftentimes the lessons that we want to teach our kids are the lessons that we may need to learn the most as well. And as we kind of got off the plane and began to go back to our house, I started thinking, how responsible am I with stuff? Because God has given other people a lot more, and it's easy for me to look at what God has given everybody else and say, well, they should be more responsible. They should use their wealth better. They should spend money smartly. They should move the kingdom of God forward. But you know, God hasn't given me as much as he has them. But that isn't the point, right? Whatever God has given me, I should be responsible for. And if he's given you more, that's okay. If he's given you less, that's okay. It's not a comparative thing. It's a responsibility thing. So I decided to start taking that seriously. I actually decided to start trying to be a lot more responsible, to steward well, to manage well what God had given to me and what he had given to our family. And then the weirdest thing began to happen. The more responsible I became, the more grateful I started feeling. It was the weirdest thing. The more responsible I became, the more thankful I was. But it wasn't a comparative gratitude. It wasn't a, I'm so grateful compared to what everybody else may have. It was this real pure gratitude. In fact, I wasn't just grateful that I had it. I was grateful that God had given it to me for something bigger than me. For those of you who have been generous before, you felt that, right? Like when you give something away, you're so grateful that you were able to help somebody else. And when you're responsible with what God has entrusted to you, it has the same effect on your heart. Not only does it begin to change you and change the people around you, it begins to foster a true sense of gratitude. In fact, I think it may be the only way to have a real sense of gratitude, through responsibility. So can I ask you a kind of deeper question for a minute? What do you have? Like, what has God given to you? Not compared to other people and not in light of what he may have given to somebody else, but like, what has God given to you? What has God entrusted to you? Maybe it's wealth. Maybe it's a gift or a skill, or maybe it's an opportunity. Maybe it's all of those things. But what has God given to you? What has he entrusted to you? And how can you begin to use it really well? How can you begin to partner with God to use what's been given to you, not to bury it and look back over the years or the decades or maybe your whole life with a little bit of weeping, a little bit of missed opportunity? What would it look like to not bury it, but to use it well? And not even for your benefit, for the benefit of others. Here's what I'm convinced of, is if you really want to become grateful, you have to start by being responsible. And if you start by being responsible, it won't just change your heart. It has the power to change every heart around you, because that's what gratitude built through responsibility can actually do.